Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the role of child labor in American agriculture. It happens every day, and it's far more common than most of us realize. We'll spend this hour with journalist Valeria Fernandez, whose reporting for Pacific Standard found kids as young as 12 working long hours beside their parents, picking fresh produce from fields and orchards throughout the United States. Some of these children fall far behind in school as they follow the harvest from one region of the country to another. But as we'll discuss, simply banning child labor would not be enough to protect the children of farm workers and keep them in school. Our conversation starts after a short break. Pay attention to the ethics of food these days. If you can afford it, maybe you pay a little extra for cage-free eggs or wild-caught salmon or veggies grown without pesticides. But you won't find a lot of labels promising your produce wasn't picked by children, because hundreds of thousands of them are laboring in farm fields alongside their parents on farms across the United States. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The laws that exist to protect child agricultural workers are mostly related to education. In fact, kids as young as 12 are allowed to work unlimited hours harvesting fruits and vegetables, provided they don't miss school. But as we'll hear, the rules about education are hard to enforce among families that migrate from place to place along with harvest seasons. And kids who fall through the cracks are sometimes so far behind that they drop out entirely by their mid-teens, with the equivalent of like a grade school education. Valeria Fernandez is an independent journalist and documentary producer. Her article, The Young Hands That Feed Us, was written with journalist Karen Coates and appears in the Pacific Standard. And Fernandez joins us from the studios of KJZZ in Phoenix. Valeria, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
We also want to welcome new listeners joining us from WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So glad to have you with us. Valeria, what kind of work are children allowed to do on commercial farms?
Well, pretty much anything. I mean, we're talking about from harvesting, from preparing the grounds, from operating in some cases different heavy machinery, getting on top of this trailers that are basically towed by tractors. Pretty much anything. And oftentimes they're working with, for example, sharp scissors and other different types of tools that could be very hazardous for them. And as you were saying, there's plenty of exceptions in the law that allow for that to happen, with them being, you know, much younger than 18 years old, which is usually the age for all of the other industries. And I mean, for agriculture, it should be 16 years old for working with this type of machinery, but that's not necessarily the case in practice. And another thing that we saw in our investigation with Karen Coates, too, is not only what the children are working with, but it's also what they're exposed to. And, you know, oftentimes they may not be necessarily working, but the parents are bringing them to the farms. And you know, a lot of accidents are happening not only on commercial farms, happening in small farms, have to do with the children just being there, spending the day and getting injured for being, you know, in a unsafe location.
I have to tell you, I was stunned to read that 33 kids are hurt every day in farm settings, and an average of 17 children die every year in these jobs in the United States.
Yes, Chris. And I mean, one of the things, too, is that, you know, half of all work-related deaths among children in the U.S. happen in agriculture, but farms employ less than 6% of the children that are working. So it's a really high rate of mortality for these kids.
Why are the laws for children doing farm work different than the laws for, say, teenagers who want to work at McDonald's?
Well, that's a really deep question, and I think it has a lot to do. We don't go as deeply into that question in our story, but I think it has to do a lot with the pressures of the farming industry and the lobbying. And also sort of this idea, I mean, as we heard from advocates, there's this exceptionalism about agriculture, this idea about trying to protect small farms. But then, you know, small farms that are owned by parents where the whole family is working. But then all of a sudden this gets extended mm-hmm. to commercial farms, and it takes this whole different dimension.
So you found that the United States is actually more permissive of child agriculture labor than countries like Brazil or Indonesia or Zimbabwe.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the researchers that we interviewed for the piece, Margaret Wirth, she did research in you know, Brazil, Zimbabwe. And, you know, in those countries, the age for doing a lot of this hazardous labor is 18 years of age. In the United States, you could be as young as 12 to be working in a farm that is, you know, with the permission of your parents, as long as you're not missing school. But in practice, it's also allowed. There's this variance, right? This discrepancy. You could have a kid as young as 8 working in a farm as long as the farm is owned by a parent. And then so many of these families are working with subcontractors that it's very difficult to hold, you know, who do you hold accountable at the end of the day for this when it comes to the enforcement when eventually, like, it could fall on the subcontractor, not necessarily on the farm. And it this is also something that can happen informally in many different ways. It doesn't mean necessarily that the kid is working there all year long, but maybe the parents are bringing their children, you know, during holidays or the weekends, but nevertheless, they are working.
And before people jump all over parents who are bringing their kids along, for some families, this is a matter of economic survival.
Yes. And that was something that was very important for Karen and I to really highlight in the story. You know, you have a lot of parents right now, especially single mothers, who are migrant farm workers, who really depend on their children and their young children and teenagers. They see their role in working in agriculture as part of being a member of the family, supporting their mothers, getting ahead, and the possibility of actually accessing an education in the future. So it gets really complicated, and there's a lot of dignity and a lot of pride, and like we say in Spanish, orgullo, that goes along and work ethic with doing this type of work in the fields. I mean, I remember one of the young kids that we interview, his name is Reyes, you know, he said, I have to have my family's back. If I don't do it, who's going to do it? And, you know, together with his mom and his stepdad, what he made helped pay, you know, the phone bill, his books, you know, things he needs for school, that sort of stuff, you know, the everyday things that you need for the school. And it makes it possible for him to continue to pursue an education. So it gets to be quite tricky.
Yeah, reading about Reyes really helped me understand how complicated this really is, because he's sounds like a very bright young man. He's a sophomore in high school, wants to be an architect. But in the meantime, he's got family members who are sick and some who need help. And he really feels this great responsibility to earn enough to contribute to his family's well-being.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Reyes, he started working when he was 9 years old. And he lives in the Rio Grande Valley. He migrates every year, now with his stepdad. But his first year, he went with his mom and stepdad to work in Michigan, and they were harvesting asparagus. And I have to tell you, after hearing his description on how asparagus get harvested, every time I cook in asparagus, I don't look at them in the same way. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in a second. But the thing is, they go to Michigan. He works there for the first year. It was his first time for his mom working also. So he was there sort of helping her when she was falling behind and not being able to pick up asparagus. You know, whatever she missed, he was trying to get. Following behind this sort of trailer hauled by a tractor, which is super uncomfortable because you're basically trying to touch your toes all day long. It's like trying to touch your toes all day long, trying to catch asparagus. So the next year, this is a family that they're very religious. Maria Magdalena, his mom, and the stepdad decided that she shouldn't go because the stepdad had a dream that she was going to be detained by the border patrol in one of the checkpoints. Now, as you know, in the area of Edinburgh in Texas, you don't have to drive too far to encounter border patrol. I mean, there is about 50 miles away from Edinburgh, there is a checkpoint there that's permanent. And because of that, she decided not to go. And that's when Regis stepped up and told her, "Don't worry, Mom. You know, I'm gonna go for you." And that's what he's been doing every single year. And the first time we interviewed him, he broke down a little bit because of all these memories of being bullied by other kids in the field, because he was a little heavyset, because he was new. And, you know, there's all of that, too, that goes along. You know, it's not only just the hard work, but being a 10-year-old, being away from your mom, away from family, having this stress and weight of responsibility of knowing that however much you can make is going to contribute to your entire household. And the other thing, as you were mentioning, Reyes has a grandfather, and his grandfather happens to be an undocumented immigrant. And unfortunately, he needs dialysis every week. And he has to wait to get treatment till it becomes an emergency so he can get a dialysis every week. And the family didn't have a car. And I think currently Reyes is saving up the money that he makes in the fields to be able to take his grandfather, to drive him himself to the hospital.
That's a lot of responsibility to manage while also trying to go to school. What are the rules? How does the migrant education program work, and how does that apply to a kid like Reyes?
Yes. Well, I think it was last year that Reyes left school a little early because the semester ends in June. And so basically in May, he picked up all his things, you know, weather-resistant clothes for the rain and all of that, and started like a 3-day trip by truck, by car, to Michigan. And before he left, he met with his school counselor, the Migrant Education Program. It was created in 1966 precisely to support children and teenagers like Reyes. And what happens is that you have the school counselors like Roberto Garcia in Edinburgh High School who make sure they keep tabs on the children's education. So let's say Reyes was going to miss a couple of tests or a couple of credits in some classes. The school counselor makes sure that when he travels to Michigan or to another state, he gets connected to a school over there where he can either take a class in his time off to compensate for the credits that he's missing or take tests. But that not always works perfectly because some of the schools in states up north, they're much smaller. Reyes was going to a school with, thousands of students. And a lot of the schools in the small towns are like, you know, they have 200 kids and they don't even offer the same classes. So one of the challenges is recovering the credits missing. Many, many kids fall behind, not Reyes, he's doing good. and that's what happened. And they get discouraged. And this school counselor that I'm mentioning, Roberto Garcia, who is part of the story, he was a migrant child himself. Now he's, you know, in his late 60s. Hope he doesn't get mad because I said his age. and that's what happened in his family. You know, he was the 18th brother in a family of 21. They migrated every year. And this is, you know, I think sometime in the 60s, 70s. And all of his brothers and sisters didn't finish school because there was all this shame associated with not taking the classes, with coming back late from working in the fields, you know, coming back in October and having to start again the same grade, you know, having to repeat to the point of quitting. So there is a lot of effort that's being done as part of this migrant education program to help these kids stay on top of their education.
My guest is independent journalist Valeria Fernandez. We're talking about her article that appears in the Pacific Standard titled "The Young Hands That Feed Us." It's about child agricultural workers in the United States. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is documentary producer and independent journalist Valeria Fernandez, whose article, The Young Hands That Feed Us, about child migrant farm workers, appears in the Pacific Standard. You know, Valeria, reading this piece, I was thinking there are not a lot of jobs that most of us would hire a 9-year-old for just because they may not be as good at it as adults and not that into it. But there's basically no risk for the farmers because often, rather than paying by the hour, they're paying by the piece. So if kids work slowly, they just make a lot less money than the adults.
Yeah, and that is an extremely important point. And, you know, even if they are paid by the piece, that, you know, that would mean how much they can gather, you know, a certain amount in a bin, that should still amount to being paid more than the minimum wage. But that's not what happens in practice. So for a lot of families, it makes sense to bring their children because, you know, even if they can do just a little bit more by having the kids coming in the weekend, they are... bringing home a little bit more money. And one of the things we kept hearing from advocates is, look, the solution is simple. If you want to get rid of child labor, then pay the parents a living wage. And that's the end of the problem. And this is something that we heard time and time again from former migrant child workers themselves and different advocates, you know, in the Rio Grande Valley and across the country. That's the situation. I mean, you have someone like Maria, who works as a supervisor in the fields. She's also been working since she was 9. She's now in her 50s. So almost like half a decade later, she's only making $8.25 the hour for working as a supervisor. Not to even mention, this is another important aspect of it, that even when the children get paid by the hour, they don't even get paid overtime. And it's only exceptional when they're provided health insurance, if you can imagine that, because they're all working as contractors. So that is something that we didn't delve as deeply into this article, but that we kept hearing, you know. So what happens if you cut a finger with a sharp scissors, or if you fall from a trailer, or, you know, what happens? And it's like, oh, you know, they have a special emergency kit. They take care of it. But there's, you know, there is this sense of like, okay, if I'm sick, I have to show up to work anyways. If I'm experiencing heat stroke, I'll just go take a break, drink a little bit of water, and then go back to the fields.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to join us. First on the line, we have Fred calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Fred.
Hello there. Thanks for taking the call. For a few years, I worked at the University of Texas Migrant Student Program, and we developed correspondence courses for the kids to be able to finish high school diplomas. One thing that always concerned me, we would meet the students once a year. One thing that really concerned me was the amount of pesticides that these children working in the fields were exposed to, not only the children, but pregnant mothers and their babies being born deaf and blind. So is there somebody that's willing to protect these children from these pesticides?
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing about that and also for the work that you do. I mean, I think that what we've seen in the last few years is, you know, there were more protections that were put in place under the Obama administration in terms of children handling pesticides, and an effort from the new Trump administration to actually roll that back to a younger age. And I think, you know, that's sort of like, you know, with all of the comings and goings of different people in the leadership of the Environmental Protection Agency, that sort of like fall through the cracks. But there was an effort to do that. And I mean, when we're talking about pesticides, it's not only their direct handling, but their indirect exposure. And I mean, time and time, we heard stories from people, you know, coming home, washing their clothes, you know, washing the entire family load of clothes together, clothes that were impregnated with pesticides. We heard stories of children being sprayed while they were working in the fields. These are stories. We haven't heard anything recent. These are stories from people that now are, you know, in their 40s. But then you're talking to people that are in their 60s and their 70s, and among farm workers you're hearing diabetes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson, you know, whole other things that have to do with back problems.
At higher rates than the general population.
Yeah. And I mean, there is research that shows that, you know, pesticides have a lot to do with this. And I mean, I was just reading, it made me think about this book, Tomato Land, that talks about pregnant women being exposed to pesticides in the tomato fields in Florida, and how, you know, they were pregnant and their babies were born with like birth defects. And there was a lawsuit out of that. And actually, there was a coalition of workers in Florida, the Immokalee Coalition of Workers out there, who actually started organizing around a lot of these issues and created a Fair Food program. So I think there are efforts out there to create labels that also let the consumer know that families and children are not being exposed to pesticides, that are not being paid unfair wages, and all of that. There's people out there doing the work, but it's definitely not enough. And especially when you have the government trying to roll back some of the few protections. And also the training, that's another issue. Mm. We don't talk about that in the story, but there's a question as to, you know, how much training are people getting to know how to handle pesticides or even how to protect themselves from exposure. And I think a lot of that work is often done by community groups and different health groups across the country.
If people were to try and combat the issue of child labor in agricultural settings by paying adults a living wage, therefore meaning the children didn't have to work, strictly speaking, to keep the family afloat, how much would that change the price of what you and I have to pay at the retail level for produce?
Well, there's research that was done by, I'm going to credit him, Philip Martin. He's a labor economist at the University of California, Davis. And he basically got research that shows that even like a jump of 40% in labor costs could result in, you know, in only like $21 per year to the consumer. Hmm. That means that if we all paid, you know, $21 more in what we buy, you know, in produce, fruits and vegetables, workers could get like a 40% increase in payment.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Don in Austin, Texas. Hi, Don.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, when the migrants return to Mexico, what would be the cost of education for the children in Mexico itself?
Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you so much for bringing that. That was something in my mind that I really wanted to emphasize. So we know that there's about 300 children that migrate every year. That is like Department of Education data through the United States, within the United States, right? They're living here. We don't have the exact number of how many are U.S. citizens, but many of them are. And talking to school counselors and people in Texas, based on, you know, what they know, quite a big percentage of those students are born here in the United States, and they're not a second generation necessarily. They might be a third generation. So when you bring the question about how much Mexico will have to pay for their education, I don't know. I think here the issue is that we're talking about also U.S. citizen children. And I think that's one of the most interesting discoveries of this story, that often when we hear the word migrant, we only think about immigrants. And when we hear immigrants, we only think about undocumented immigrants. Hmm. And this is a much diverse population. And yes, definitely you have a lot of new arrivals, new people that are coming in, and they begin this cycle. Because it is a cycle, it's a generational cycle. And these kids that are now second generation, they have parents, they had grandparents, like we have in the story, who came from Mexico, started all this work. Their parents did it, and now they're doing it themselves. And we're also seeing how they're getting out of it to go to the university. Like, for example, Leslie, I can't remember her last name, but it's one of the former students from Edinburgh High School. She now is a nurse working in the hospital. And every year she takes her toddlers to during the break, during the summer, to the north. I think it's somewhere in Illinois. So her little kids can see the type of work that her parents do, and they remember where they come from and where the food that we all eat comes from. So, you know, you have a lot of that.
So the high-end estimates are as many as 540,000 children doing this work in the United States every year. Is there a reason there's not an exact number? Is nobody specifically tracking how many kids are picking the food that you and I eat every day?
Yeah, it's a little it's a little difficult to pinpoint that number. And I think it's also because so much of it goes under the radar, right? And I mean, when we were going to the fields in Texas, and you know, it's not easy to tackle this topic without a lot of people getting defensive and being like, no, absolutely, you can't have children working in the fields here. They have to be as old as 18 years of age, and then even though the law actually says they can be 12. So I think part of the reason why we don't have specific data is because it flies under the radar. What we do know, or what really helps us, is this information that the Department of Education keeps from the children that are in the migrant program. But there's so many too that end up dropping out of school, and we lose track of them.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, Valeria, you told us a little bit about how hard it is to pick asparagus, and you're bending over all day and touching your toes. Can you talk about what it's actually like to pick food all day? I'm thinking about for a child, like, are people talking in the fields? Are there conversations going on? Is it very quiet and very, you know, painful? What does it feel like for a kid to be doing this work for hour upon hour, whether it's just in the summers or all year long?
All right. To borrow a line that was written by my colleague Karen Coates, in the fields, talk is time and time is money. Mm. So there is this really intense, fast pace to the work that they're doing, and there's no time wasted. Sure, you know, a few jokes here and there, but one of the images that we got from a former child worker was, it's just like showing up every morning at 5 in the morning and looking at the field and just seeing how it was endless, you know, almost eternal. Like, no matter how far ahead you got in the furrows, it was always more to go. Mm. It never ended, right? And in other places, it just like it seemed like the layout was different up north, and you know, they would just like turn around the corner and there was more field and more field and more field. And in many occasions, especially in those areas of the country where it rains, they're getting soaked all day long. And, you know, you could be wearing rubber boots and you could be wearing a raincoat and all of that, and it's not even enough. In Texas, I mean, we were there just like at 9, 10 in the morning in October, in March, and it was unbearable for us
the heat.
Just to be, yeah, for a few hours. And then can you imagine, in the heat, can you imagine just like all day long working, you know, under that extreme heat, what it does to you, to your health. And then coming back home, absolutely exhausted, to, you know, start all over again another day. We were talking with a family that migrated this year, if I can remember right now, it was Indiana. And their 12-year-old daughter was going to start working for the first time this year. It was going to be 7 days a week, 9 hours a day. And the mom had to get up like at 3 a.m. because somebody was coming to pick up the younger toddlers for daycare, and then work all the way through till 6 or 7, you know, only to come back home, feed the children, wash the clothes, and start the process again. And that's also what the kids are, you know, are seeing. And, you know, another thing that, you know, I can't forget is also what that experience is like for these children, you know, going to different parts of the country where there's not necessarily like a lot of diversity, a lot of really white areas where, you know, they will come back. For example, Reyes will be coming back from work, you know, all covered in dirt with a sombrero, literally like one of those big Mexican sombreros, mm-hmm. showing up at a restaurant and people, you know, looking down on him because of the way he was dressed or the way he was you know, and then he was just basically sent to a separate area to sit and eat. Mm. So that's another part of the experience for these children too, sort of feeling people judging them just based on the way they look. And I think there was something really beautiful that Reyes said, but I don't know if you have it. But I would like to read it if I find it. It's basically talking about, here it is. He says, you know, I get it, you know. They don't want us to sit all dirty next to the people that are eating the food. We get it. But just try to be a little more gentle. Try not to judge the people that are doing your food.
And another irony is a lot of people in the situation of Reyes and his family can't afford the very produce that they're picking for other people.
Yeah, that's one of the, I think, bitter ironies of this whole situation. And we focus mostly on the area of Texas, you know, when the families come back and what their life is. And there's research done by Proyecto Azteca and one of the universities out there that, you know, food insecurity in the colonias there is over 81%. But we can talk a little bit more back after the break.
We will. Thank you. Valeria Fernandez is my guest. She's an independent journalist, documentary producer. She's got a piece in the Pacific Standard right now called The Young Hands That Feed Us. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with independent journalist and filmmaker Valeria Fernandez, whose article The Young Hands That Feed Us, about child migrant farm workers, appears in the Pacific Standard. Before the break, Valeria, you were telling us about food insecurity among migrant workers, especially when they are sort of living wherever they live in the off season.
Yes. So we focus on the Rio Grande Valley area, and there is a group there, Proyecto Azteca, who's done a lot of research, and they do a lot of work with families that are living in colonias. What are colonias? I mean, they're like temporary neighborhoods that basically, when they're set up, like a lot of like the basic services, like electricity, plumbing. So these areas are kind of like suburban, off from the city. They don't have a lot of grocery stores, big grocery stores. They have a lot of corner stores, dollar stores. And so sometimes you will find moms, you know, going to a corner store instead of buying, you know, a gallon of milk for $2 in the regular massive grocery store, having to pay $5 for milk, and also just not finding produce and good quality produce. And ironically, they work all day long in that, and they can't feed their families fruits and vegetables because they don't have the access. Their work hours are long, even when they're, you know, back in Texas, because a lot of them not only work up north, but they're working all year long. You know, they sort of chase the seasons. And it happens, too, when they go out up north. It was one of the kids was telling us that sometimes what they do is they actually have an app to order food delivered from Walmart. Mm-hmm. So, you know, technology these days. and these kids are really up to speed with that. But it's also like difficult, too, in some parts of the countries for them, ironically, to have access. So as I was mentioning, Proyecto Azteca, what they found out is that food insecurity in this area and these colonias in the Rio Grande Valley is like 81% compared to a national average of 18%. And they worked together with a Children's Medical Center in Dallas and a Yale New Haven Children's Hospital. And part of what they noted was that this, you know, how does this food insecurity translate into what, right? Well, malnutrition among some of the residents, obesity, diabetes, you know, some of those problems. So those are not only tied to pesticides, but they're also tied to the way, the conditions of living for a lot of these families.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Joe on the line in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Joe.
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I do have a question for Valeria. So, Valeria, have you experienced or talked to any children of former farm workers or migrant workers who actually are doing well in their life just because they learned the lesson of working hard? It seems like you're exaggerating more of the negatives when there is a lot of positives. I myself am a former child of migrant farm workers. We cut asparagus. I picked cherries, apples, pears growing up, and I am a doctorally prepared nurse in San Antonio, so I've gotten my doctorate degree. But there is a lot of positives that the family is actually able to be cohesive because they're out in the field together. I didn't experience anything that you're describing. It seems like you're exaggerating more the negatives, but there is a lot of positives. And one thing that I'd like to just know or have you know is that my parents were able to make more money because they had the kids working out there because a lot of times they got productivity bonuses. Yes, they got paid on the hour, but the more asparagus they cut, the more bins of apples they filled, the more money they made, which improved our lifestyle.
Well, thank you so much for your perspective, Joe. I appreciate your call. Do you want to respond to that, Valeria?
Yes, Joe, thank you very much. I hope you have a chance to read the story because we do go into a lot of the positives. And I'm kind of bummed to hear that you think we only focus on the negative. I mean, we heard time and time and time from these kids about how they learned the value of work, how they learned about a good work ethic, how some of these kids really make the best of the time that they had in school because they knew, okay, during the summer, I'm going to go and work in the fields. I'm going to go help my grandfather. We're all going to work together. We're all going to have each other's backs. And when I come back to school, I have no time to waste. I have to be a good student. So it made them better students. It made them more diligent. It made them more focused. And we see that with Reyes. You know, he wants to become an architectural engineer. You know, he's very clear on the fact that he wants to go to the university. And that's what we see not only from the children, with a lot of parents. One of them, you know, was telling us, yeah, we bring them to work with us on the onion fields during the weekends because we want them to understand the value of hard work so they actually focus in school and, you know, get an education and you know, go up the next step to a better job. And sometimes, you know, sadly for a lot of these families, immigration status for the parents is what keep them from progressing. One of the men that we feature in the story, I mean, he's a mechanic and he wished he could work as a mechanic. But sadly, he can't find a permanent job due to the fact that he doesn't have documents. So he can only find work in agriculture and does little gigs on the side to work as a mechanic. I was talking earlier on about the story of Leslie Limas, one of the graduates from Edinburgh High School who went on to become a nurse. And, you know, she's working now in the field in this hospital, but also every year goes back to she goes back north with her parents who are like in their 60s and are still working in the fields so she can show her younger children where she comes from and where the food comes from. So I think there's a lot of honor, a lot of value, a lot of pride that goes with this type of work. And oftentimes the young children and teenagers see it as being part of a family, contributing I cannot tell you, Chris, how many homes we visited that were built by these families. Huge homes with beautiful kitchens and many rooms that were built over decades, you know, by the grandfather, now passing it on to the children or to the grandkids. And you see, you know, the tangible fruits of all of this hard labor in building homes and also in sending their kids to the university and giving them a better future. So definitely, I think one of the strengths of our story is that we actually do explore that and that we look at the perspectives of the families and not just the hard reality, but we also have to report about that too and the risks that are involved with this type of work.
All right, let's go back to the phones. The number 800-933-5372. Patrick is calling from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, ladies. I'm in Texas today, actually from near, I live near Bakersfield, California.
Okay.
I'm a truck driver and I've hauled produce and other perishable goods all the way from Maine, the cranberry fields, to southern Florida and Oregon and Washington, and also including all the some of the meatpacking factories in Nebraska, et cetera. And to me, it really is an awful dilemma of what primarily Spanish adults and their children are going through, even worse than ever. And I can't imagine not being able to report a violent crime because somebody being scared of being deported or abused even more. And Joe just called up, and, you know, maybe Joe, that she's not actually not exaggerating, but not maybe telling some of the horrendous stories. You know, it would not be appropriate to say on the radio because it gets so bad sometimes. And just as a person who's worked closely with people that pick the food and pack it and ship it, for sure, it seems like a lot of people, especially the you know, it goes back to the 1%, the ultra-rich, don't appreciate where their food comes from, their flowers, their nursery plants, their meat they eat. And, you know, thankfully, there is a lot of good people, and I just like to say that love is stronger, and you're not exaggerating how bad it is.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Patrick. I really appreciate it. Anything there that you want to respond to, Valeria?
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. No, I definitely appreciate hearing from somebody who's out there, very close to the people, and I hope that we have more callers sharing those sort of things. No, I mean, I think he's absolutely right. We're talking about two different things, you know, these horrors and the abuse and the risk that these families face. And yeah, and the fact that because of immigration status, not only in agriculture, but in all other forms of employment, they often get exposed to abuse and harassment because, you know, it's easy to just threaten, you know, I'm going to call immigration on you, so shut up, don't ask for a break, don't ask for more money, don't report the sexual abuse. That's a reality, but that doesn't take away from all the love and all the pride that these families put in the work that they do. It just makes it, frankly, tragic that they have to be exposed to this type of conditions of work. And I mean, I think we've seen a lot of reporting done, especially in California, about the type of abuse that women, especially working in the fields, are exposed to. And also, you know, in Florida, there's been a lot of reporting and lawsuits too about, you know, people kidnapped and, you know, forced to work basically into slavery. And, you know, and the fear of coming out and reporting that being so great. And we definitely felt that when we were in Texas. There was a ICE sweep in the agricultural fields in California, but everybody knew about that in Texas. So there was a little reluctancy from some of the workers to talk to us because of that fear. And they're there every day working very close to the border fence and with Border Patrol coming and going.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, Valeria, if we don't want to be complicit in the overuse of children, you know, working in dangerous conditions, if we want to make sure that we're eating food that represents people who are paid a living wage, It's much harder to do that when you're trying to protect the rights of human beings than when you're trying to protect animal rights, right? I can pick up a package of eggs and it will tell me how that animal was raised that produced the eggs. I don't necessarily see throughout the produce section a lot of signs telling me that, no children were injured or exposed to pesticides in producing this orange or this potato.
Yeah, I mean... That is really sobering, I think. And like as I was saying, I think both Karen and I, after doing this story, I don't think we looked at anything that we buy in the same way. Mm. I mean, Karen's been involved in food reporting for a long time, so I'm sure she was way more aware than I was. But yeah, I mean, there are efforts. I didn't mention there is the Equitable Food Initiative in Washington that basically puts what is called the EFI label. And, you know, there's at least 13 farming operations over the U.S., 3 in Canada, 14 in Mexico, 1 in Guatemala, that are, you know, that are letting consumers know that the farm workers are being paid fair wages and also that they're like, there's safety and the pesticide management. But ultimately, it's consumer, you can think it's a consumer-driven market in a way, right? When everybody got word that, okay, free cage chicken and all these other products that are organic sell well, then, you know, they start producing more of that. So, you know, I think the consumer, and this is not just me saying it, but a lot of the human rights groups that we talk to and advocates are insisting that consumer plays a big role in demanding this from the distributors, the farming companies. And it could be done. I mean, there's, as I was mentioning earlier, you know, this coalition in Florida who got that done for tomatoes and got everybody involved, the farmers, the distributors, creating this fair food program and letting consumers know that the workers were paying fair living wages, that they were given breaks, that they were not handling pesticides. And they created a whole system of monitoring that and actually, like, you know, making sure that it happens, right? Because that's the other part of it. You see the label, but who's enforcing that label?
So we have to start asking questions where we shop, is what you're saying.
I think so. And I think plenty of people are in the habit of doing that for other reasons, right? I mean, like the joke, you know, about, oh, this chicken, well, what was its name? And where, right? Yeah, I think we need to start thinking differently about the produce and the food that comes to our tables every day. Not only comes from very young hands that feed us, but also from very old hands and for generation after generation of migrant workers that have made their home here in the United States.
Valeria Fernandez is an independent journalist and documentary producer. That article in Pacific Standard is called The Young Hands That Feed Us, written with her colleague Karen Coates. Valeria, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast and check out upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.